Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hi, this is Donna Sebo, and welcome to an Hour of Mind Power. We've got a very special guest today. Her name is Dawn Bailiff, and Dawn, thank you for calling in. We were having a bit of a problem connecting there. Hello, Dawn. Can you hear me?
Yes, hello.
This is Donna Sebo, and it's a delight to have you on the show today. You have written an absolutely phenomenal book that is titled Notes from a Minor Key. And this is a memoir, your personal memoir, of music, love, and healing. And on the front cover of your book, there is a statement by Leonard Bernstein that Dawn plays with most veracity than any young pianist I've ever heard. The sublimity of her artistry is mystical. You have such a phenomenal background, and of course we're going to be playing some of your music in just a moment, but you were a world-class concert pianist. You soloed with most of the major symphonies and philharmonics on 5 different continents, including Berlin, Vienna, Prague, London, Tokyo, Chicago, and L.A. I mentioned Leonard Bernstein. You had Carlo Maria Giulini, Eugene Ormandy, and Sir George Solti. You are a composer yourself, and your work has been performed by major orchestras in various parts of the world. Not only that, but you speak 5 different languages. You are a translator and an internet marketing consultant for Fortune 500 companies. You've been involved as a journalist, a technical writer, a banking officer, and a college professor. Gee whiz, I'm pooped just from reading all this stuff. You are a phenomenal, phenomenal woman. And before we go into your personal story, we have set up to play up just about 2 minutes of one of the pieces of music that you performed. And after we do it, we're going to play it for a couple of minutes, Dawn. So, Dawn, if you've got it all set up, let's go and play 2 minutes of this wonderful, wonderful music, and you'll hear the magic of Dawn's fingers bring music to a different dimension. Hi, this is Donna. As you can hear with the magnificent music that Don was playing, it is absolutely magical. Don, when did you start your musical career?
When did I start playing, or when did I actually make it a career?
Well, when did you started playing when you were just a little person. When were you first on the stage? When was that? How young were you?
First time I was on stage, I think I was around 7 years old. And then I started really being serious about it a year or two after that. I mean, I just was so drawn in by it, you know, the experience of being on stage and just the electricity and the keys. And it just seemed to snowball from there. By the time I was 12, I was doing tours by the time I was 12, so it happened relatively quickly. I mean, it didn't feel like it was happening quickly at the time, but when you're a kid, nothing seems like it's happening quickly.
Well, I know that you played with Leonard Bernstein when you were 10 years old.
Right.
And then you were accepted into the Peabody Conservatory of Music at Johns Hopkins University at 15.
Right.
And you're a woman that I found your story was so poignant, because when we find out about someone like you, most of us are going to, when we first hear about you or watch someone like you performing, we're ooing and awing, and we're just in this wonderful state of admiration, wondering how in the world would we ever have an opportunity like that? Could we ever have an opportunity like that? But your music, though you were a child prodigy, it was more than just music. You were an artist that came in with these phenomenal talents, and you were also very gifted psychically as well.
Right.
And so between those two components of yourself, you went beyond what most people would ever dream of experiencing. I mean, it was so much a part of you. And you were just totally committed to it, weren't you?
Oh, definitely. And it's nice to hear you say that. I mean, it's a strange experience to have someone say that, because I certainly, it doesn't feel that way to me, but it's interesting that it looks that way from the outside. And it's kind of neat hearing that, but it's kind of surreal too.
Well, it is such a unique expression. And throughout your book, you speak of different experiences that you went through and how when you were playing the music, it was just, it expressed through you. You actually could feel some things that I don't think many people would imagine that an artist could feel. But I do understand that. And you were given so much wonderful talent, musically and psychically. You have in your book a question. Why would one be given such talent only to have it taken away? Mm-hmm. Why was I given myself, my identity, so early, when it was that very self that would nearly kill me? And those were two very powerful questions right at the beginning part of your book. When you wrote this book, I know it was to honor, respect, and to leave a legacy for people. But there's so much passion in your words. There is so much passion in the self-awareness that you expressed through your writing that I could hear even when you were playing your music. It expresses itself through the written word as well. You say how in coming close to death, and you've gone through a lot of physical challenges, which we'll talk about, you said it's brought you closer to life, closer to your past life, and even closer to a future life. And you talk about how your body, how you put your body through so much abuse when you were young, it was like ignoring a crying baby. Sooner or later, the abuse will come back to haunt you. And rightfully so. And that your pain was a wake-up call. Tell us about how you began to recognize the signals of your body.
Well, multiple sclerosis is a very surreptitious disease. I mean, it sneaks up gradually, and at first you think you're losing your mind because you have these symptoms that you don't necessarily identify as symptoms. They're just disconnects from your body. Your hand goes numb, or it takes its own action without you telling it to do so. Your leg gives out from beneath you. You have strange senses of heat or cold in different parts of your body. You lose vision in one of your eyes. You can't find the right words. You can't articulate what's in your head. So these kind of symptoms pick at you, and usually for most people with MS, you go to doctors and you present these symptoms, and because we're usually at the prime of life, I mean, and particularly because we're most likely women, we're not taken all that seriously. I think it's getting better now because MS awareness is really accelerating in the last couple of years, but, you know, back when I was diagnosed, it still had a long way to go. Still has a long way to go, but I mean, it's much better. But, I mean, I went to so many doctors, and, you know, that dismissed my symptoms and, you know, dismissed. And it was just because the symptoms were so hard to articulate and so hard to put into words, I felt like even the people around me, I was even afraid to tell them that because a lot of people, you know, when you achieve a lot at a young age, there's a lot of people that are very jealous of you, particularly in your own family. And people really kind of want to see you fail. Unfortunately, it's a terrible thing, but it's true. Mm-hmm. So I think around my teens is really when I first started seeing symptoms, and I started pushing them away because, you know, when I would explain that to some people or just kind of allude to it, the people who were so-called close to me who kind of didn't want to see me succeed in the first place, really, I mean, they would say to me, well, you're just overstressed, or you're too concerned with your body, or, you know, you're making it up or whatever. And then when you go to doctors and they tell you, oh, I can't find anything wrong with you, or you're just under too much stress, or you need to get more rest, you start to really question your body's signals. So that's why I say it was a wake-up call for me, because it forced me to really look at that and say, okay, am I connected to my body? Do I know what's going on? You know, is this pain real? Am I feeling something real, or am I kind of superimposing something on my body?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, like so many artists, the work, the involvement, the dedication was so intense. And you talk in your book about those years of performing, the intense schedule, how many times you didn't even have enough money for a good meal.
Right.
It was the push, the striving, the drive that was so demanding. But in those years, you had the chance to meet a very special man by the name of Paul. Tell us how you met Paul and how you felt that he was the man for you.
Well, I don't know if I felt that initially, but I met him at a competition that I was doing, and he had come backstage that I had lost, a competition that I had really sincerely wanted very much to win and had played my best, and was pretty down at that time because I knew that it was the best I could do, and it obviously wasn't good enough. So it wasn't as though I'd made a bunch of mistakes and felt like, oh, I wasn't having an off day. I mean, it truly was the best I could play. So that was, I was in a pretty despondent state at that point. And, you know, he basically said, you know, you were really great, and he had given me the encouragement, and he just loved my music. And that's how we met, strangely enough. And from that, we just developed a more of a verbal friendship for a while and more of a spiritual friendship that gradually evolved, and until we just seemed to need each other's presence more, and our thought processes paralleled each other so much that we just felt almost incomplete without the other one. And that took a while to evolve. We had many obstacles that kept us from being together for a time, but it was a slow process. But I can't really say when I actually knew. I mean, I don't remember like a eureka moment when I said, oh, here's my soulmate. I think maybe it was almost after the fact that I realized that.
Now,
because one of my themes in the book is really about how your soulmate is really your time of correction. It's not your time of bliss and happiness, but in many cases it's a painful looking in the mirror and realizing, oh my gosh, you know, I have a lot of warts, and I'm seeing them reflected in this other person.
Now, you also, in this book, you did something rather unique. You wrote a chapter about you, Don, and then you'd write a chapter about Paul.
Right.
And it was a fascinating shift to be able to go through, because you put each other as you would view each other through your own eyes,
mm-hmm.
per se. And that was quite a unique positioning to be able to put in a book. And you ended up going over to Europe for a while and performing. And he had been involved, if I'm remembering correctly, with a woman by the name of Gina.
Right.
And then there was this point in your book where you talk about your sixth sense about people, their motives, their feelings, and even their pasts.
Right.
And you talk about being able to propel your consciousness into Studio 3, where he was. And you said you just were in this whole different space. It was like a remote viewing experience.
Exactly.
And you saw him as a child, and you got so much information about him.
Right.
How was that confirmed for you?
How was it confirmed? And well, as I became further in the relationship, I mean, you know, those things came out on their own time. Of course, a lot of that I really didn't reveal. It's something I probably wouldn't have written had he still been alive. I mean, I know I couldn't have written this. That's a terrible thing to say, but
mm-hmm.
I know I couldn't have written the book that way had he still been alive, because certain things I wouldn't have felt comfortable doing, like that, for example, you know, showing that. But now in context, I do believe that we all connect together. I mean, from, you know, the so-called dead and the so-called living. I mean, I don't even know what that means anymore, per se. You know what I'm saying? So we all
mm-hmm.
I think it's a continuum. So once that happens, I just feel like we all kind of understand one another. So I feel a lot better about it than I would have had I still been in a physical relationship with him. But really, in answer to your question, really, that just came up better with time. I didn't really need it confirmed because I already knew it to be the case. I mean, that experience was enough for me to know that. I mean, I don't second guess my intuitions. I don't second guess my remote viewing, so to speak. I mean, I believe it to be so. So I didn't need to have it reinforced in the physical. But of course, it was over the course of time and through conversations and just through, you know, meeting family and friends and those kind of things. But that was, of course, a gradual thing. But I didn't put much stock in that because I already knew.
Mm-hmm. Now, Paul had a bipolar disorder.
Right.
That he told you he had problems with. Both of you were so creative as individuals. Both of you were so challenged by various things. What made you decide that you wanted to become a team?
That's a good question. I guess it's just the point of just feeling like it was the right thing to do. I mean, I think in many cases it was painful for us to be together, but it was even more painful not to be together. And I think in many ways the whole thing about the soulmate being painful and it being part of a soul correction, and in many cases not being a fully pleasant experience, I mean, in many ways I think we kind of, you know, we danced the porcupine dance, so to speak, and I'm not sure that we jumped right in with both feet, but I think, it just came to the point where it was okay. As painful as this is to be together, it's worse not being together. And it just seems like we keep coming back to that, and we were meant to give that a shot. I think it really was that awkward and that rough.
Now, Paul was sort of like you in that he would try to ignore or bypass the need that he had to have a certain kind of medication, and
mm-hmm.
he was a very artistic soul, just like you, which I've already said. But you, when you were really hit with MS, you were on stage, and
mm-hmm.
you collapsed in front of 2,000 people. Your body, all of a sudden, just wasn't going to work anymore. It's as if it decided it was going to crash and burn right there. And that must have been an experience. That, how in the world did you handle that? I mean, so many of us go through challenges in life, but here you are, you're at the epitome of a career that you have dedicated your life to, you've literally starved at times, you've had excruciating schedules, you've had this passion and this dedication, and then that was the end.
Mm-hmm.
What did you do?
Well, I guess I just became something else. I mean, I really, you know, have had a metamorphosis into something else. That's really the best way I can say it. Not to say that happened right away, but I think the old self has to die, and that's a pretty painful process to be able to open up and be the new self. And so I think one of the tricks, if I may say tricks, I mean, I don't know to that, is being able to really feel the pain of that, kind of like what Alice Walker talks about. I mean, Alice Miller. I always confused Alice Walker and Alice Miller. They're totally different writers. It's mm-hmm. my MS doing that, a dyslexic moment. But Alice Miller, you know, the German psychologist, talks about that, about, you know, not being able to really recover until you allow yourself to really embrace the pain. And I think that is really key. And I had learned that as a performer. I had learned to kind of embrace physical unpleasantness to get to the other side. So in many ways, I think I used the discipline that I had learned as an artist to my life. I applied it to my life, and the lessons I learned psychically. So I think those two things together. I had already learned that discipline as a musician. So it was really just applying that same discipline, realizing that you do have to kind of go through certain things to get to the other side. You just have to do that. And then you really can survive it if you're able to embrace that. But if you're afraid to feel that initial pain, then you may not survive. That's the irony. And the pain is going to be a whole lot worse. But it's like, you know, you try to protect yourself on the short end of the short term, you protect yourself, and then you end up being destroyed in the long term. But it's a hard lesson to learn. But I think, like I said, being an artist, I had learned that through just trying to try, you know, trial and error of trying to become a great artist and failing and trying again and doing the best I could and being, you know, having the criticism that you receive in that world and as you said, the physical hardships, because there's only a handful of classical musicians who anybody remembers. I mean, at my best, I was still a B-level musician, so that's still, as far as I went, I was still not like in the top five of the world or anything like that. So just to give you an idea how hard that is, you know, and it's just to realize how much you have to sacrifice just to get even in the playing of that, to get even in the ranking of that at any remote level. So once you learn that, you can apply that to almost anything.
I agree with that, and I like the way you've stated it, that once you've earned it, there are no shortcuts. You have a sentence
That's
in your book where you say, the difference between a great artist and an ordinary mortal is all in the details of handling limitations. Ordinary mortals are oppressed by them, while great artists are inspired to create ways around them.
Exactly. And that's the same thing. Exactly. Beautiful. Perfect quote for that.
And
you, that's perfect.
You and Paul got married, and then you ended up having a family. For those of you who are listening, I'm talking with Dawn Bailiff. We're talking about Notes from a Minor Key. This is her memoir of music, love, and healing. And believe me, it is a powerfully written book. And when we close out, we'll play a little bit more of her music. But, Dawn, you had a baby boy named David.
Right.
And he was a wonderful gift into your lives.
Right.
But then David had some problems.
Right.
David was a gift that was given to you, but it was going to be a short-term gift.
Right.
And tell us a little bit about David.
Well, he died when he was two of a congenital heart defect. So after a series of surgeries, I mean, he had several surgeries, and so it was most of his life was a life of illness and waiting for the shoe to drop, I guess, is the best way of saying that. I mean, just knowing that, not necessarily knowing that it was inevitable, but thinking, okay, there's a pretty good chance. So there was a sense of reality of that. And then, you know, there was always the hope that certainly things would get better or certainly he would respond better, but he never really responded as well as some other kids did with his, you know, with his condition. So I always had a definite sense of the inevitable there. But, I mean, he was, as far as who he was, I mean, he was certainly he was certainly our child because he was creative and I'd like to say, of course every mother says this, but I like to say precocious. I mean, although I realize, okay, we all say that. All mothers say that. But, but that being said, I'll say it anyway. but yeah.
So and then you
it's
had...
It's hard to know. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's very
hard to
know.
It's hard to know what he would have been, you know.
So you had him as a gift for 2 years. It was a very difficult time because your son had a lot of challenges that he had to go through.
Yes.
You and Paul did the best that you were able to do, loving him every moment that you had him.
Right.
And then he passed away.
Right.
And then there was a very difficult time. And then your husband went through very difficult moments, and then he decided to make his exit. You have had so much that has hit your life. You have had so much that has, for if many people read your story, would say, why go on living? Why even bother? Everything that was so precious to you, your career, your son, your husband, all was gone. Why did you keep on?
Well, it really goes back to the quote that you had just read, and I think you find creative solutions, and it just isn't my way to just stop. I mean, I don't know really how to do that, first of all. It's just, I'm always looking for a creative solution. That's what inspires me. But on a more basic level, I feel like, I definitely believe in eternal life, and I believe that it's a continuum, as I said earlier, and so I don't believe that ending your life is an answer to anything, because we're here, we're given things for soul correction, we're given things to teach us things. It is true that in many ways we should kind of say thank you to our enemies and the people that persecute us, because they are our teachers. It's hard to always do. But if you think about Christ on the cross, if he had not said, forgive us, Father, they know not what they do, wouldn't have the impact. If he had said, you lousy people, I hate you, His sacrifice wouldn't have had the same impact. So in that, I think was an example to that. And Socrates is another, you know, great example of that as well, of being able to say, okay, that which I have drawn upon me, that which I need for my soul's correction, whether it be in the form of people, whether it be in the form of illness, whether it be in the form of sorrow, better to get it through with it now than have to repeat that in the next life. I mean, we have attracted these things to us on some level because we need it for our own development. So by pulling the cord on that, it doesn't solve anything. You know, we're not going to go to this state where we can just ignore it. I don't believe that. I believe, okay, we're going to have to face it on some other plane. So why not address it now and then move on and hopefully learn our lesson from that? So.
I love your analogy that you have in here, and it's a true one. You said you were coming back from visiting your son's grave one day, and you ended up getting a flat tire, and you managed to get to a repair shop, and you saw an ad for Pirelli tires, and I'm quoting from your book, you said, Pirelli makes a type of tire that just sucks up nails and keeps going. What an idea, I think. I'd love to be able to do that. Suck up all the nails in my path and keep going unscathed. And that's what you've done. You have written an awesome book here. I think you have told a story not just about MS and the way that you've dealt with it. You address the issues that women sometimes have to face. You address pain. You have had so much in your life that's an example of courage and stamina and excellence. And I think that for anyone to read your book, Notes from a Minor Key, it is a memoir of music, love, and healing. It is also a story of someone who has just gone through such a routing of life experience that if someone reads it, I think they will identify on so many different levels with you. But you're a wonderful example to any of us who would have the privilege of reading it, which I did. Dawn, you have a website.
Yes.
Where can people go to find out more about yourself and this wonderful book? Also, your music.
Okay. Yes, it's www.members.aol/my name, DAWNBAILIFF. I'm sorry, I lost the .com here. It's www.members.aol.com/DawnBailiff.
Well, Dawn, it has been a delight. We're going to be closing out here, saying goodbye on the interview, and then we'll be playing a couple of minutes of your music. Thank you so much for being my guest.
Thank you, Dawn. I really enjoyed it.
Well, it's been a delight. Again, her website, members.aol.com/DawnBailiff, BAILIFF. That's where you can find out more about this wonderfully talented woman and her true story. We're going to be taking a break, and we'll be back after a couple of minutes. Don't go away.
Deal with diabetes, high blood pressure, osteoporosis, or chronic pain? Do you want to know one of Dr. Perricone's 7 secrets to beauty, health, and longevity? Do you have 15 minutes a day to look and feel better? Then let me introduce you to TTAP, the workout that works. For the beginner or expert exerciser, learn from physical training specialist Teresa Tapp how, in just 15 minutes a day, you can burn fat and sugar, build strong bones and muscles, and lose inches fast with no equipment or jumping. Visit the TTAP website, ttap.com, or call 1-800-342-0717 to learn how. That's T-TAPP.com. We'll help you lose inches, look good, and feel fabulous at TTAP. 1-800-342-0717. TTAP.com.
Hi, this is Donna Sebo, and telephone lines are now open. If you'd like to give me a buzz and let me light up your life with a little bit of insight, I'd be delighted to do that. Here are the numbers, 877-876-5227. That's 877-876-5227. Canadians, 888-815-9756. That's 888-815-9756. And we also have another direct line of 530-876-3222. Now, all you need to do, if you've not ever called in before, is just dial one of those numbers. When we get on the line, all I need from you is your first name or your initial. Then after that, let me tell you what my mind shows me, and you're welcome then to ask a question when I'm finished. And also, I want to let those of you listening know that I'm down here in beautiful, sunny California. I mean, it is just gloriously golden with sunshine, and I'm going to be here for a conference speaking for a few days. So the broadcast will be coming live from the Los Angeles area. Now, tomorrow we're going to be, because I have a speaking engagement, we'll be playing The Best of Donna. But we'll be back on Friday live. We're going to be talking about the chase for beauty. This is a story, a true story, about a physician and his family, and Robert Mendelsohn is going to be our guest. This is a story about some interesting situations that happened to a physician, his family, and how they were able to work through them. By the way, I think we might have found out about some of the things that were corrupting our computer system. So if you want to send me an email, you have a special story, something that you want to share with me, go ahead and send it to Donna@DelphiInternational.com, and I'm sure it's going to be able to go through, or at least I'm keeping my fingers crossed. To the best of my knowledge, we discovered a couple of things that were corrupting files, and so emails could not get through. So we're getting it done little by little, and we're being educated in the process, as most of you who are, well, real savvy with technology that are listening to this show, you know what that's like. I received some information, a wonderful story, and it's actually about a bit of history. Have you ever heard the term Kilroy was here? Well, this came from Debbie, and it's a fascinating bit of historical information. And it goes this way. In 1946, the American Transit Association, through its radio program Speak to America, sponsored a nationwide contest. They wanted to find out who the real Kilroy was. They offered the prize of a real trolley car. That's right, a trolley car, to the person who could prove himself to be the genuine article. Now, there were 40 men who stepped forward saying, "I'm Kilroy," but only one man, James Kilroy, from Halifax, Massachusetts, had evidence of his identity, and this is the story that went behind it. Kilroy was a 46-year-old shipyard worker during the Second World War. He worked as a checker at the Four River Shipyard in Quincy. His job was to go around and check on the number of rivets that were completed. Riveters were on piecework and got paid by each rivet that they put in. So Kilroy would count a block of rivets and put a check mark in a semi-waxed lumber chalk so that the rivets wouldn't be counted twice. Now, when he went off duty, the riveters would go back, erase the mark, and later on, an off-ship inspector would come through and count the rivets a second time, resulting in double pay for the riveters. Well, one day, James Kilroy was called into his boss's office. His boss was really upset because he became aware of the amount of money that was being paid to the riveters and knew it was more than what it should have been. And he wanted James Kilroy to investigate. Well, when James did some checking, he finally figured out what had been going on. The tight spaces he had to crawl into to check the rivets didn't lend themselves to lugging around a paintbrush with a can of paint, so he decided to stick with the waxy chalk. Now, he continued to put his check mark on each job he inspected, but he added Kilroy was here in king-size letters next to the check, and eventually added the sketch of the chap with the long nose peering over the fence, and that became part of the Kilroy message. Once he did that, the riveters stopped trying to wipe away his marks. Now, ordinarily, the rivets and chalk marks would have been covered up with paint. However, it was wartime, and ships were leaving the Quincy Yard so very fast, there wasn't time to paint over his cartoons that he was drawing. As a result, his inspection trademark was seen by thousands of servicemen who boarded the troop ships that the yard produced. Kilroy's message apparently rang a bell with those servicemen because they picked it up and spread it all over Europe and the South Pacific. Before the end of the Second World War, the name Kilroy had been here, there, and everywhere on the long haul to Berlin and Tokyo. Now, to the unfortunate troops outbound in those ships, however, he was a complete mystery. All they knew for sure was that some jerk named Kilroy had been there first. As a joke, U.S. servicemen began placing the graffiti wherever they landed, claiming it was already there when they arrived. So James Kilroy, just his last name though, became the U.S. super GI who had always already been wherever GIs went. It became a challenge to place the logo in the most unlikely places imaginable, and someone said it's on top of Mount Everest, the Statue of Liberty, the underside of the Arc of Triumph, and even scrawled in the dust on the moon. Now, the war went on. The legend kept getting bigger and bigger. Underwater demolition teams routinely sneaked ashore on Japanese-held islands in the Pacific to map the terrain for the coming invasions by U.S. troops, and thus, presumably, were the first GIs that were there. On one occasion, however, they reported seeing enemy troops painting over the Kilroy logo. In 1945, an outhouse was built for the exclusive use of Roosevelt, Stalin, and Churchill at the Potsdam Conference. The first person inside was Stalin, who emerged and asked his aide in Russian, "Who's Kilroy?" This guy was everywhere, or at least his name was. To help prove his authenticity in 1946, James Kilroy brought along officials from the shipyard and some of the riveters. He won the trolley car, which he gave to his 9 children as a Christmas gift, and set it up as a playhouse in the Kilroy front yard in Halifax, Massachusetts. Well, that's just a little bit of trivia. I thought it was a lot of fun, and I want to thank Debbie for sending it to me. This is Donna Sebo, and we have those phone lines open. If you want me to light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight, give me a buzz at 877-876-5227, 888-815-9756 or 530-876-3222. Well, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, I've got some cheesy stuffed pork chops. Doesn't that sound good? Maybe a little Italian-style broccoli rabe? Well, that might go together very nicely. So if we have time, I'll be sharing some recipes with you. Don't go away. We're going to be back in just a moment. Donna Sebo here. We'll be right back.
Do you have a group, organization, or club that would like to have an interesting and dynamic speaker? Then you're going to want to have Donna speak to your group. She motivates audiences towards personal empowerment, giving them tools for their personal and professional success. If you would like Donna Sebo to bring a presentation to your next event, call Delphi International at 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604.
Hello, this is Dr. Richard Petty, the author of Healing, Meaning and Purpose, and creator of the RichardGPettyMD.com website. I am thrilled and delighted to tell you that starting February 7th, 2008, at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern, I'm going to be joining my friend Donna Sebo on her show on BBSRadio.com. We're going to do this every month, and I can guarantee you that we're going to be sharing new information and new concepts that will astonish and inspire you.
If you're searching for the perfect gift for a child, consider God's Kiss by Donna Sebo. That's right, Donna is not only a mental practitioner and psychic, she's an author as well. God's Kiss beckons all children and the young at heart to enter the dream world of a little traveler named Johnny. You can order your book today by sending a check or money order to Mrs. Sebo's Classics, Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington 98497. That's Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington 98497. If you'd like both the book and cassette, you pay only $19.95 plus applicable tax and shipping charges. This is the book for your favorite child of any age. Donna Sebo's God's Kiss is about a child's sense of place in the world, and it's destined to be a children's classic. Order now. Call 1-800-872-8852. That's 1-800-872-8852. God's Kiss is written by Donna Sebo and illustrated by Ed Gedrose. Buy it today. 1-800-872-8852.
Hi, this is Donna. I don't know about you, but sometimes you want to find a way to enhance food that maybe you enjoy. In our household, we really enjoy pork. My husband's from the South, and that's one of the favorite meats of anybody from the South, typically. And I came across this cheesy stuffed pork chops, and I've fixed stuffed pork chops before, and they're absolutely wonderful, and they're always a hit with guests. But this one with the cheese is just a little bit of a twist that I think you might enjoy, and also the Italian-style broccoli rabe. If I have a chance, I'll be able to share that with you as well. But I thought I would just share these two recipes. Now, by the way, if you want to give me a call, here are the telephone numbers to call into, 877-876-5227, that's U.S., Canadians, 888-815-9756, and also 530-876-3222. Okay, got that pad of paper and pen handy? These are really good. All right, you're going to want to preheat your oven to 400 degrees. Just get that all ready and hot. And here are the ingredients. Let's write them down while that oven is heating up. You're going to need 4 center cup cut pork loin rib chops. And if you don't want the ribs, you can get the thick chops and just put a pocket in them if you don't like the ribs. I know sometimes people don't like to serve those to guests because they have to cut away from the rib, but whatever is your preference. Either way, you're just going to have to make a pocket in it. And then you're going to need a half of a red apple cored cut into 8 thin slices. Any nice, firm, crisp apple like a Gala is very good. You're going to need 4 slices of Swiss cheese. It's about a half-ounce cheese each. And you want to use Gruyere cheese. Then you need about 1/4 teaspoon of crushed dried rosemary, 1/4 teaspoon of crushed dried rosemary, 1/4 teaspoon of salt, and 1/8 teaspoon of pepper, 1/4 teaspoon salt and 1/8 teaspoon of pepper. Have handy 1/4 cup of apple jelly, and you want to warm that so it's liquidy, melted. You want 1 tablespoon of Dijon mustard, and you might want to use a garnish of apple wedges and maybe some fresh rosemary. But have all of your ingredients ready to go because it won't take long to get this done. And what you want to do, like I said, is take those pork chops, cut a 2-inch wide pocket into the middle of them. And if you're keeping the ribs in, you want to cut the pocket so that the knife is going up against the bone. If you're not, just be aware you want to leave like about 1/4 inch at the back of the chop if you're not using it with a rib. So when you make that pocket, you don't want to cut it all the way through. What you want to do, you want to fill each pocket with 2 thin apple slices and 1 cheese slice. And you want to secure the openings of the chops with toothpicks. And sprinkle both sides of each chop with rosemary, salt, and pepper. Then you want a large oven-proof skillet, and you want to, on the top of the stove, you want to cook your chops turning once. You want them nicely browned on each side. It's about 5 minutes it's going to take on each side. Your apple jelly and your mustard, you mix it together. You brush the top of the chops that are now browned with 1/2 of the jelly glaze, and then you put it in your oven. A nice cast iron steel skillet is really good to use. A heavy skillet is really good for this. And you want to bake it 6 to 7 minutes or until it's beginning to brown, and you turn and brush with the remaining glaze. And then you bake it another 6 to 8 minutes or until it's no longer pink near the bone. If you have a thermometer, you can check to make sure the internal temperature is correct. Then what you'll do when those are ready, you remove the picks and serve the chops with the pan juices and then garnish them with apple wedges and rosemary. Now, if you want a nice dish to go along with it, and this can be easy. This is so easy to fix. This just takes minutes. Italian-style broccoli rabe. This is so healthy. It's so pretty when you serve it. You're going to need 1.5 pounds of your broccoli rabe. You get those at any market that's so popular today because it's one of the most nutritional greens you could ever eat. 2 tablespoons of pine nuts, 2 tablespoons of olive oil, 2 tablespoons of pine nuts, 2 tablespoons of olive oil. You need 2 cloves of garlic minced real finely, 1/2 teaspoon of salt, 1/4 teaspoon of pepper, and then 1 cup of grape tomatoes. You want to have those halved in advance. Real simple. You cut off and discard 1 inch from the stem ends of the broccoli rabe. Then chop it all up in a large pot. You put in 2 cups of water, add a little salt, bring it to a boil. Put in the broccoli rabe, cover it, cook for 5 minutes. That's all it takes. Then you drain. And then in a large nonstick skillet over medium-high heat, you have your pine nuts. You stir them in the oil, and then they get golden. Takes 1 to 2 minutes. Take them out of the skillet, and in the same skillet heat, a little bit of the oil over the medium-high heat. Add your broccoli rabe, your garlic, your salt, and pepper. Cook until it's just tender. Takes 5 minutes. Toss in the tomatoes. Let them warm up, and they're going to be ready to go with those delicious, cheesy, stuffed pork chops. What a wonderful meal. Flavors that'll tickle your taste buds, deliciously so, and you will just please everybody no end. They're just going to think, wow, this was a lot of work, but actually it isn't. Stuffed pork chops, good stuff. Donna Sebo here. Give me a buzz if you want to chat. 877-876-5227 or 888-815-9756. Now, don't forget, tomorrow is going to be a pre-recorded program, The Best of Donna, because I'm going to be doing a speaking engagement. On Friday, however, we are going to be talking about The Chase for Beauty. Robert Mendelson is going to be my guest. A fascinating story. A lot of things you would never have expected to hear about. And they're going to be told on Friday. And we've got a wonderful lineup of people, and that lineup will be put up and posted by the 2nd of March, because being on the road, as I am, I haven't had a chance to get everything in to the system. So even on bbsradio.com, everything's going to be a little bit late this month. So just know that, and don't worry about it, because I will be getting to it. Do you think the Earth's poles are going to flip positioning again? What do you think? There's all kinds of speculation. Do you know the North Magnetic Pole has moved quite a bit in the past 400 years? But scientists really cannot make a prediction about when it's going to happen again. The Earth's magnetic field seems to change its positioning at regular intervals, but we don't know when it's going to happen. All we know is that it moves, and it's moved around, the North Magnetic Pole has moved around the Arctic north of Canada by as much as 6 miles per year. And these last 10 years, it seems to be picking up speed and started moving north at about 25 miles per year. So going back, they can go backwards in tracing history. They say the historical positioning of the magnetic poles going back millions of years can be read from various magnetic minerals found in lava and other rocks. And the minerals have shown that the magnetic field has reversed direction about every 300,000 years and that more than 780,000 years have passed since they last shifted. So scientists are speculating, it could happen any day. But they say it's not just the magnetic field that changes its orientation over time, but also the strength of that field changes. And they say in analyzing minerals found at the bottom of the ocean, it shows that the magnetic field has weakened 10% since the 19th century. Mother Nature doesn't sleep. She's always doing, she's always surprising us, and she'll continue to do the same thing. Well, this is Donna Sebo broadcasting to you live from Los Angeles, California, where the sun is shining, and we'll be back with you same time, same place tomorrow with The Best of Donna and live again on Friday. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. This is Donna Sebo. It's a great day to be alive. Appreciate all your blessings. Enjoy. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.
This is singer-songwriter Robin Avery. It's a privilege to be on BBS Radio. You've been listening to music from my new release, The Way You Hold Me. Come visit me and check out the CD at robinavery.com.
Down from the-